This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Raucous, unpredictable, unsettling. Three words that can easily describe this year's race for the White House. Here's another. Divisive. We are as divided as a nation as we have been, some say, since the Civil War, and the divide is wide. Partisans on both sides see distinctly different Americas and simply cannot understand how anyone could vote for the other party's candidate. Still, we are united in one thing. We all want the best person for the job to win, to unite the country and keep us safe. So, given our choices in this election, how do we reach that goal? And given that one of these two candidates will win, how does the losing side come to terms with the fact that the nation won't disintegrate with the other party's winner in the White House? How do those people uneasy with either or both of these candidates make a decision in the voting booth that they can live with? Perhaps a look back into history would help. In this case, a look back at the traits of those who were considered among our best presidents. Do Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton share any of those characteristics? Dallas trial lawyer Talmadge Boston has done the work for us. He spoke to a number of presidential historians about previous occupants of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue for his book, Cross-Examining History. A lawyer gets answers from the experts about our presidents. And Talmadge Boston joins us for the hour. Welcome to Charlotte.
Glad to be here, Mike.
Nice to have you here. Incidentally, Mr. Boston will be speaking at 11:30 at the Charlotte City Club for the World Affairs Council's Charlotte Luncheon. You have to register to go, but there are seats available, and you can get information about that at our website at WFAE.org. You are a commercial trial and appellate lawyer from Dallas, Texas. You've written books about the law. You've written books about baseball, and you're like George Will, another baseball writer. What led you to your interest in presidential history?
I fell in love with presidential history when I was 7 years old. I was an avid baseball card collector, and it caused my mother to get worried that all my brain cells were being devoted to RBI and ERA. So in a bookstore in Houston for my seventh birthday, she found a set of presidential trading cards that were just like baseball cards, except they had the pictures of the presidents on the front and information about their lives and presidency on the back. And she knew I would memorize that information the same way I was the baseball. So that really got me started. And, of course, growing up in the early 60s with the New Frontier and then Kennedy and then the drama of the Kennedy assassination, and the next president was a Texan. I grew up in Texas, Lyndon Johnson. And then, of course, the presidency of Richard Nixon, which the Vietnam fallout, the resignation. I mean, the presidency has been a pretty dramatic place throughout my life, and I've always had a fascination for it. But also, because I've spent my career as a lawyer, so many of our presidents have been lawyers. And, of course, our greatest president, Abraham Lincoln, was a fantastic trial and appellate lawyer just like I am. And so there's been a real lifelong connection, both from a being interested in history, but also in the news almost all the time, and this connection to the law.
So before we talk about what you've discovered about some of our best presidents and who considers them our best presidents and why, talk about these two candidates. What are your impressions of the two people we have a choice of in this election?
I think we're in a unique position because never before have we had two candidates who both had negative approval ratings and are deemed untrustworthy by more than 50% of the American people, according to the polls, which means we are truly in a position of having to select the lesser of two evils. The evidence is very clear that both of these candidates have high levels of integrity issues, and that's always troubling when you're having to make a choice and you know that the person you're voting for has a record of dishonesty, but that's the choice we're having to make. And so, as you say, somebody's going to win, and we have to look at, I mean, yes, we know where they are on the issues, but we also know that upon people becoming president, these issues have a way of falling by the wayside because the world changes and you have to respond to the world crisis.
Despite the tumultuous nature of the kinds of things that we've lived through with presidents since 1963 when the assassination of John Kennedy occurred in Dallas, baby boomers lived through a lot, and presidential power has increased a lot. And I think that's in part because of the television age. It's easy. We want a star, and the president becomes the focal point, the star, because he's one of many in the government and lives in a big White House, and that's taken on mythical proportions. Has there been anything like this? Have there been two candidates facing each other in history before, perhaps before the modern age, that you could compare this contest to and these contestants to?
Well,
or
presidents,
where they were equally challenged in terms of integrity.
Short answer, no. we have had candidates who were perceived to be, quote, loose cannons before Donald Trump. I mean, some people certainly thought that about Andrew Jackson. Some people certainly thought that about Theodore Roosevelt. And in many ways, they were right. Obviously, Hillary Clinton is our first woman nominee, so this makes this election unique, but not only our first woman, but also a former first lady. So there is this tie-in with her husband, who obviously is a mixed bag. Bill Clinton, in many respects, a very successful president, but on the other hand, of course, somebody whose shenanigans led to his impeachment. So there's so much conflicting information that each voter has to reconcile. And we also have to recognize that today's media is playing such an important role in forming opinions. The left media obviously wants to demonize Trump. The right media obviously wants to demonize Hillary. And so, like never before, voters are challenged this year to make up our minds in the midst of a barrage of conflicting information.
And it's not unlike the kind of journalism that we witnessed in the early days when every city had four or five or six newspapers and they took a political point of view and hammered it home viciously and relentlessly. We have that kind of now in the cable sphere.
Yeah, the difference is in the past, when people relied on newspapers as their primary source of news, you'd get the newspaper in the morning and you would read it, and sometimes you'd get some newspapers in the afternoon. But it wasn't this 24/7.
Right.
It wasn't in the evening getting barraged with all kinds of e-blasts from different news sources and a multitude of channels with talking heads who are essentially entertainers attempting to gain ratings and thus revenues for their networks. So we are far more overwhelmed with information than at any time before in our history.
So in your book, Cross-Examining History, A Lawyer Gets Answers from the Experts About Our Presidents, you spoke with 31 presidential historians over the course of 2 years. When did you start working on this?
In 2013, and actually I spoke with 25 historians and 6 White House insiders,
Okay. People
who actually had served with presidents, Henry Kissinger, James Baker, and so forth. But the substantial majority of the people who I interviewed in the book are major biographers of every significant American president, beginning with George Washington. I did not get a biographer of either Bush 43 or President Obama because I think it's too close in time. But because I had access and a friendship with David Marinus, who'd written a big book on Bill Clinton called First in His Class, I have an interview with David Marinus, a Pulitzer Prize winner, in the book. But it was a 3-year project, 2013 through 15. For the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, I was doing regularly on-stage interviews with best-selling authors, mainly presidential biographers, as well as public figures, as they would come to North Texas for their programs. And I decided that what was being said in these conversations was important. And so I started recording them with their permission, obviously, transcribed, edited. And then in February 2015, I decided this is bookworthy. I had a publisher who said it was bookworthy. And so to complete the project and get it out in time for Election Day, 23 of the 34 interviews were done in a 10-month period in 2015.
You are noted for doing a lot of homework as an interviewer, which is commendable, laudable, I must say. A lot of homework for that. But I guess that comes from your experience as a litigator. When you're going up into a courtroom, lawyers ask a lot of questions, and they usually ask questions that they already know the answers to because they don't want to be surprised with a witness on the stand because that might turn the case. So when you sit down with presidential historians and people who worked at the White House with the president and watched history being made, are you looking for pure truth, or are you looking for answers that maybe confirm what you suspected.
No, I'm looking for pure truth, and that's certainly always been my goal as a lawyer. I want the truth to prevail in a lawsuit. I want the truth to prevail in our evaluations in history. I don't want our historical conclusions to be based on wishful thinking or piecemeal, incomplete information. And so in preparing for the interview, it's James Baker, one of the people I interviewed for the book, has what he calls the five P's that are his mantra, and they've become my mantra. Proper preparation prevents poor performance. And so as long as I'm fully armed with information going into an interview, I know it's going to go well. Mm-hmm. I know the person I interview is going to respond well because they're going to know they're going to see the level of preparation, and they're going to be more forthcoming. But an important consideration that made them all feel comfortable with the process of doing the book was I told each of them he or she would have the final say in the final words in the book. I didn't want anything in the book that had not been fully blessed by the person who I interviewed to make sure that nobody could say they were misconstrued or misquoted. And so every interview is fully blessed by the person I interviewed.
Talbot Boston is our guest. He's a trial lawyer and an interviewer and an author, written Cross-Examining History, A Lawyer Gets Answers from the Experts About Our Presidents. He picked 21 of our greatest presidents. We'll find out who they are when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today to Talmadge Boston, who is a Dallas trial lawyer and author. His latest book is called Cross-Examining History, A Lawyer Gets Answers from the Experts About Our Presidents. This comes from a series of interviews that he conducted before live audiences with 25 presidential historians and six people who either lived and or worked in the White House with presidents. You have said that your decision to conduct this series of interviews over the course of time was part of a commitment to become a proactive force for the study, discussion, and advancement of presidential history. Why was that so important to you, and why should it be important to the rest of us?
Well, the key word in that sentence is advancement. Anytime you read a presidential biography or memoirs, invariably it raises questions in your mind that the book does not answer. And so that was what I was trying to do in each of the interviews in my preparation, was to identify what I considered the most intriguing aspects of each president's life and time in the Oval Office, and identify what appeared to be gray areas from what the author was saying, and to try to use the interview as an opportunity to turn that gray into either black or white, or to advance the ball of his conclusion beyond what he had said in his book. And so I think that's very important. That's the way we move history forward. Ken Burns earlier this year in his Kennedy Center Jefferson lecture said, history is the set of questions we in the present ask of our past. And so I was the questioner for these 31 people to try to move them forward beyond what they'd said in their books.
So who did you choose to talk to, and how did you choose them?
It ultimately depended on who I had access to, but I made sure that everybody who I interviewed was recognized as a leading authority. And so because I was doing these onstage interviews with the World Affairs Council, as of 2013, Scott Berg, a Pulitzer Prize winner, had his biography of Wilson came out. I did that interview. James Tobin, a National Book Critics Award winner, had his book on Franklin Roosevelt come out. I did that interview. Henry Kissinger came to town to speak to the World Affairs Council. I did that interview. But then when I formulated, yes, I'm going to make this a book, I then had to identify a major biographer, respected biographer of each significant American president. So, for example, George Washington. Obviously, I reached out to Ron Chernow, who won the Pulitzer for his biography of Washington, but he's too tied up in the Broadway show Hamilton. So who am I going to get? The next day in the Wall Street Journal, a huge favorable review of a new George Washington biography by a husband and wife award-winning historian team, David and Jean Heidler. She's a professor of history at the Air Force Academy. And through my network of historians, they gave me an introduction to the Heidlers. I said I would come to Colorado Springs and do the interview with them. And so people generally wanted to cooperate when they knew, number one, they were going to be part of a book with Henry Kissinger, David McCullough, and Ken Burns. And number two, nobody was going to put something into a book that they had not fully blessed.
So did you set out, you've chosen 21 of our most significant, I misspoke a minute ago, I called them our greatest, but they're not all great presidents. They are significant presidents. You've put them in the book. Did you set out to choose these 21? Had you already chosen these 21 and you found people who could talk about them? How did the process work?
The process was, as a student of presidential history since 7 years old and being able to know the presidents in order since that young age and having a familiarity, I don't think there's much dispute about who our 21 most significant presidents have been. After Andrew Jackson and until Abraham Lincoln, all those presidents were largely forgettable. After Ulysses S. Grant and before Theodore Roosevelt, all those presidents were largely forgettable. In the 20th century, William Howard Taft, a one-term president, didn't make the cut. Warren G. Harding, who was in office for only 2 years, didn't make the cut. Jimmy Carter, a one-term president, Gerald Ford in office less than 4 years, didn't make the cut. Basically, everybody else did anybody who writes a book is aware of the audience. Should I have put in James K. Polk instead of John F. Kennedy? Yes, there's an argument to be made, but I know that people in 2016 would rather read about John F. Kennedy than James K. Polk. Plus, I didn't know.
People here. He's from here, you know.
I was hoping for an audience out, including North Carolina, but beyond the state of North Carolina.
So the 21 who are in the book, Washington,
Adams
Jefferson
Monroe, Madison.
No Monroe,
Madison, the father of our Constitution, is always rated higher than Monroe, and Monroe's actually been in decline in recent years. And then Jackson, and then Lincoln, and then Ulysses S. Grant, and then Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Calvin Coolidge, who has had a rise in stature in recent years as our best president at managing the budget and getting control of the deficit. Hoover, who's not a great president, but he was the president when the Great Depression hit, so I thought that was important to understand how he responded to that crisis. Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, Bush 41, and Bill Clinton. And then finally, I didn't have a historian for Bush 43, but I did have access to Andy Card, who was his White House chief of staff for 6 of his 8 years. I know Andy. I know what a great storyteller he is. And to have in the book his description of what happened on 9/11, beginning with the Florida Elementary School, and what happened on 9/14 when Bush went to Ground Zero with the bullhorn and consoled the victims, I thought would be a nice addition to the book. So Bush 43 is covered in the Andy Card interview.
So again, because Nixon's on this list and several other presidents, people's eyebrows may have gone up had they thought we were talking about the greatest presidents. These are significant presidents because of things that they did or didn't do. And you have said that we shouldn't want, when looking back at past presidents, we shouldn't want to access them based on half-truths or wishful thinking. We should want to know them, warts and all. And in the Twitter sphere in which we live, we're seeing lots and lots of warts. We can't get away from the warts. We can't see the goodness for all the badness out there. Is that how you see it? And what is that doing to us?
Well, before the current generation of historians, most of the prior generations subscribed to what was called the great man theory of history. Mm-hmm. They only wanted to cover the good parts of the person's life and presidency, and they wanted to give short shrift to what Thomas Jefferson was doing with the slaves at Monticello, how Andrew Jackson was treating the Native Americans who was pushing off the lands, etc. But in the modern era, and I think this is a good thing, and this is what Ken Burns, who wrote the foreword to my book, does with his films, we want to understand the emotional archaeology, his words, of these people. They are human beings. They are flawed. They make mistakes. But let's get an appreciation for them, warts and all, and hopefully the good from these largely great presidents will more than overcompensate for their flaws. As you mentioned, in today's world, people want to demonize, for example, Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, because they were slave owners. But that's using a 21st century racial sensibility toward people who were living in the late 1700s and early 1800s, long before the Civil War, long before the Civil Rights Act, and were simply trying to make a living on southern farms where there was no machinery, no real equipment, no labor force. And so if you're going to run a large farm, and at that time in the South, slavery was legal, they did what it took to make their farms work.
As you mentioned, until recently, we really didn't focus on, maybe didn't even know about some of the human failings of our presidents. It was very well hidden that FDR could not walk. No one really knew that. Photographers were not – they didn't take pictures of him in his wheelchair very often. We didn't know that John Kennedy suffered from Addison's disease. He was ill in his entire presidency. We didn't know anything about his sexual peccadilloes. It was shocking when we found out to a lot of people.
It is shocking.
And LBJ had the sit. He was also inclined in that direction, as was Dwight Eisenhower, and that was shocking to find.
Well, Eisenhower was during World War II in his famous affair with Kay Summersby, but he had put that behind him, and there's no account of that being an issue at all or any activity during his White House years.
But so now we have a man who is running for president, who is embroiled in this controversy about his sexual activity or his I'm not even sure how to describe it, but Donald Trump is embroiled in this, and we all know what it is. But he has referred to Bill Clinton's sexual misbehavior in the Oval Office. Other people have referred back to John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson and Dwight Eisenhower and Thomas Jefferson, who had an affair with a slave, for God's sake. This from a man who wrote, "All men are created equal." How do we reconcile and get past these things and determine whether these are good people, bad people, or just human beings with failings who might be good presidents for us?
Well, they are all flawed human beings, and anybody who thinks otherwise simply hasn't been paying attention. And so it's the history lover's job to try to do an inventory, the good, the bad, how much emphasis are you going to put on the bad? How much credit are you going to put on the good? And to me, that's the fun of history, recognizing we're not dealing with messiahs here. We're not dealing with Jesus who served in the White House. We're dealing with people who put on their clothes the same way you and I do, who have had the same life issues that you and I have
had.
But
we do tend to put these people on a pedestal. We want them on that pedestal. We want them to be better than us.
We do want them. And in many cases, obviously, they are better communicators, better visionaries, better capable of building consensus, better capable of seizing on perfect timing in pursuing their initiatives, better capable of persuading the public sentiment to align with their visions. They have special skills, the great ones do, that separate them from the rest of the pack and make them our greatest presidents. And so we just have to appreciate the good and recognize that they were merely human beings. And therefore, the diligent historian in the modern era is going to come up with some troubling aspects to their lives, and we just have to accept it.
And some of the people on your list of the most significant presidents came under withering criticism during their time in office, a blistering criticism, not unlike some of the criticism we're hearing thrown about these two candidates they were having to vote for this November. So how would you compare these candidates to those who suffered the slings and arrows of their own time?
Well, the difference between now and then is that we have much more information now, and people can retrieve it instantly, such that when a candidate says something that's inaccurate, in the old days, maybe people would have figured out it was a Pinocchio, maybe they wouldn't. It would have taken a whole lot of effort to pull up the prior conflicting statement. Now it's done instantly, and so we have this immediate awareness of the inaccuracies in what they're saying.
So do you think that will ultimately, maybe not now because we're in the midst of transition, that will ultimately lead to better people because they won't be able to get away with lying?
You would think so, and yet you look at these two candidates this year, whenever either of them says something that is false, they presumably think they can get away with it or they wouldn't say it.
One of them is. Well, maybe both of them are. I mean, the partisans on both sides don't want to see the flaws. Donald Trump has said that he could shoot somebody on Broadway and get away with it. And pretty much he's done everything you cannot do if you want to win, and he's still in the race, and his supporters have not fallen away.
It is an amazing phenomenon, and ultimately what it's about as to why they don't fall away is two things. Number one, many voters see it as entirely about the next president's choices for the vacancies that arise, and one even exists now in the U.S. Supreme Court, that is the most important consideration. They don't care if either of the candidates, some obviously want conservative justices, and then others want liberal justices, and that's it. They think this is the most important factor in the election. I think, obviously, that is very important, but that's not so dominant a factor that we should ignore everything else. The other aspect besides the U.S. Supreme Court is this is the one thing in my mind that the Trump campaign has done right. This is an election between an insider and an outsider. If there's ever been an insider, it's Hillary Clinton, former First Lady, former U.S. Senator, former Secretary of State. Most people recognize that our current federal government is a mess. And so to put in an insider who has contributed to this mess would seem like a foolish thing to do, whereas Trump, the outsider, no prior political experience, maybe he'll cause a disruption to make this existing system work better. That is the thought process. I'm not saying I agree with that. I'm just trying to explain why we have this phenomenon that we do.
So many questions and not enough time. But when we come back with Talmadge Boston, we're going to go through the Ten Commandments of our next commander-in-chief, a list of things that you have come up with, and we'll see how these two candidates do or do not pass that test. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Talmadge Boston. He's a Dallas trial lawyer, author, and professional interviewer. He's written a book called Cross-Examining History, A Lawyer Gets Answers from the Experts About Our Presidents. He talked to 25 presidential historians over the course of several years and six people who either lived and or worked in the White House while history was being made. He's in town under the auspices of the World Affairs Council Charlotte to speak at the Charlotte City Club at 11:30. Tickets are still available. You can go to our website at WFAE.org. To get in. Let's go through the Ten Commandments that you've come up with, the Ten Commandments for our next commander-in-chief. How did you arrive at these?
When my book had gone to the printer, I was having lunch with a good friend of mine and brainstorming how should I best market the book. I obviously planned to speak all over the country, but also to come up with a speech and some insights that could go beyond the presidential election. And so he suggested everybody, every organization cares about leadership, what makes for great leadership, what are the most important traits that people in leadership positions should aspire to, and what can we learn about best practices in leadership from our top presidents. I thought that was a great idea, so I went back and reread all 31 transcripts in the book looking for discrete traits in leadership that perhaps people hadn't completely recognized and been able to put with a tight story. And when I got through, there were 10 of them. So I thought, okay, 10 commandments, that's kind of catchy. and so I came up with 10, and it's something we all, you know, everybody in a leadership position or aspiring to a leadership position, in my opinion, ought to be thinking about how they grade in these 10 areas, but also it's a useful metric for people to think about in this very challenging choice we have to make between these two candidates.
Well, let's race through these then. The number one commandment is thou shalt be conscience in chief. What does that mean?
I mean, we always think of the president as commander-in-chief, which he or she is. Conscience-in-chief means you have the highest level of integrity, and you can be counted on to do the right thing when times get tough or when you think no one is looking. And to me, that's the most important of the Ten Commandments. And obviously, as we've been talking about for the last several minutes, we have both candidates who have major integrity issues, and that's what makes this choice so difficult this year.
So each of them has broken that commandment more times than we can count?
Correct.
Wow. Number two of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt build consensus. Is that possible in today's political environment?
If I was asked to grade President Obama in his administration, I think he has not done enough. Yes, from time to time.
But the day he took the oath of office, Republicans said, we're going to make him a failed president. We're going to obstruct him at every step of the way.
There were some Republicans who said that. Some Republicans have tried to do it. That doesn't mean he should not try on a regular, steady basis, which is exactly what Thomas Jefferson did coming into office with the same high level of polarization, where during the Adams presidency, the Sedition Act had been passed by the Federalist-controlled Congress, and people were being thrown in jail. Yet Thomas Jefferson, over the course of his 8 years, had a steady stream of dinner parties where his only invited guests were the leaders of the Federalist Party, and that's how you build a dialogue, you build relationships, and you build consensus. I don't believe anybody has said President Obama has attempted to do that.
So given the polarization of the electorate in this election, do you see either of the candidates we have being able to or being willing to do that?
Answer, not necessarily. I mean, at least Hillary Clinton has served in Congress. She was a United States senator. She has an awareness that for Congress to work, there must be consensus building. There must be compromise. That is the only way legislation historically has gotten passed. And so at least she has that awareness of it. Presumably she wants to succeed as president, which requires succeeding with Congress. She at least should get that picture. Donald Trump, with no prior political experience, has no idea how Congress works, has no idea whether to succeed in governing, you must reach across the aisle. So that in my mind, there's a much uncertainty about him in this commandment, whereas at least she knows what it's all about.
And isn't that part of the problem with people who say we should run the government more like a business? And here we have a chief executive of a billion-dollar company running for president, and he'll be able to fix America because he's a businessman. But he's got 535 members of his board of directors who have more power than he has.
Well, of course, that's basically been the situation with President Obama, with his ongoing frustration over Congress's inability to pass laws. He has now routinely started issuing executive orders. He's not the first one to do that, but he's done it more than any prior president. In a way, I understand that. If I'm elected president, I want to do certain things. If we have this Congress that's so dysfunctional it cannot pass laws, then I presumably want to attempt to do something in furtherance of the goals that I ran on. But this is the situation we have when we have a Congress that doesn't work and doesn't coordinate with a president, government stops working, and we have a whole new way of governing involving presidential orders, which may or may not be constitutional, and we'll see in the next few years whether they pass constitutional scrutiny.
So number three, thou shalt know and supplement one's limitations. Is this about surrounding yourself with good people and let them do their jobs? And if that's what it's about, do you see either of these candidates being able to do that?
It's about more than that. What it's really about is self-awareness. It is we want a president to know what he or she is strong in and what he or she is weak in. And in those areas where they know they're weak, to get people into their team who has strengths in the areas where they're weak and be able to partner with them. And that's exactly what James Madison did with Alexander Hamilton, with George Washington, with Thomas Jefferson, such that the two of them together in each of those instances were better than either of them was individually. So this is really about self-awareness and be able to identify and reach out and bring into a personal partnership somebody is too strong in the areas where you're weak.
Number four of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt remain calm in a crisis. Does that include not engaging in Twitter wars over that crisis?
I certainly hope so. I mean, the president I have in mind here is President Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when all of his advisors, and we have the 43 hours of the 13 days conversation over what to do about the Soviet missiles in Cuba, all of his advisors were ramping up, demanding strong retaliation to get the missiles out. He was the only calm head in the room. He negotiated settlement. The missiles got out, and he thereby avoided World War III. President of the United States is in a position to trigger or avoid World War III, And so we need somebody who in that mode is not going to panic, is going to stay in a mode of good decision making, and is going to have people at the table who can help him make those good decisions in a crisis.
Who might be best at that?
It's about the temperament. We don't know much about Trump's responding to major crisis. Yes, his businesses have had some setbacks, and he has ultimately rebounded. Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton has certainly had an adult life of crisis mm-hmm. by reason of her marriage, by reason of the actions she has taken in government that have caused her to be deemed so untrustworthy. Both of these people have a high level of resolve. Neither of them has faced the kind of presidential crisis that only the person in the Oval Office faces.
Number five, thou shalt not be defeated by setbacks. And it seems to me that both of them have successfully persevered in the face of setbacks in their lives and careers. Would you agree?
Yes, I would. I mean, that's really about steadfast resolve. I mean, the metaphor is we think of boxing. When somebody gets knocked flat on their back, who's going to have the resolve to get back up, dust themselves off, and return to action and doing what it takes? And we think, of course, of the way Franklin Roosevelt responded to losing the use of his legs with polio as the ultimate example of that. I agree that both of these, like everybody in life, you overcome setbacks. Yeah. Not many of us have to think about losing the use of our legs, but I think both of the candidates have demonstrated over either their business career or political career that they, in fact, have overcome setbacks.
Number six, thou shalt play hardball when necessary. Both of them seem willing and able to do that. Would that be true?
Well, I don't think Hillary Clinton has what you would call a distinguished record during her time as Secretary of State. As part of the Obama administration's foreign policy. When you talk about playing hardball, obviously that can turn bad if you play hardball and there's a major adverse result which triggers a World War III. Mm-hmm. So the real commandment here is to play hardball skillfully when you've got the leverage, when you've got the power, the way Eisenhower did in handling the Suez crisis, to understand how best to respond. People are going to get out of line. We see that in the world today. We see what Putin's doing. Are we playing hardball with Putin? No. Do we need a president who's ultimately going to have to play hardball with Putin? I would say yes, or he will just continue his aggressive outreach. And so I think the next president must be able to deal from a position of strength with hardball if we're going to try to bring this world into some kind of order that's favorable to the American perspective.
Number seven, thou shalt be mindful of good timing when pursuing initiatives. How do we judge these two candidates on that?
Well, of course, Hillary, in her political career as First Lady, presumably thought, she and her husband thought the timing was right to pursue health care reform, and it was not. It was defeated. During her time in the U.S. Senate, to my knowledge, the only bill that she actually sponsored that went through was a bill to name a post office after Thurgood Marshall. So we don't have a track record of her in perfect timing. Now Trump, no political experience. He's moved forward with bad timing in some of his real estate investments, some obviously with good timing. So it's really hard to say one is more favorable than the other in this commandment.
It's a draw. And number eight, thou shalt be a great communicator. Wow.
Well, a great communicator and be able to follow through. I mean, we've obviously learned in recent years that some people are very capable of giving great speeches. But the great communicator not only gives the great speech, but in fact follows through and does what he or she says. And so on the one hand, for example, Donald Trump in many ways is a good communicator because, after all, look at all the people who support him. Does he have the capacity to follow through and do what he says? We don't know. He's never held elective office before. Hillary Clinton obviously is challenged in her communication. No one regards her as a charismatic, dynamic speaker. And so As between those two, you might have to give the edge to Trump, even though obviously the things he says, not the way he says them, but the things he says in many cases are very troubling.
We only have a minute left. So one of the other ones is number nine is thou shalt put the nation's welfare above one's own interest. Do they both lose on that point?
Well, we know from Hillary that in setting up the email server, she was obviously putting her personal interest above the country's security. We know from Donald Trump's withholding of his tax returns, he doesn't want the country to know about exactly where he is. So I agree. They both have real problems on that commandment.
And number 10 is thou shalt stay abreast of public sentiment and find ways to shape it. Are you disturbed? Are you confident? Are you optimistic? How do you feel about what we're about to go through in November?
I don't say anybody could feel confident. The only thing we can feel good about is we do have a history in the presidency of presidents who came into office for which many people had very low expectations, and we became pleasantly surprised. And so that's really my hope, that despite all these misgivings that we justifiably have about both of these candidates, that whoever wins, upon being sworn in, recognizing that huge responsibility, will elevate himself or herself and, in fact, attempt to live up to what our great presidents in the past have done.
And we'll leave it at that. Talmadge Boston, a Dallas trial lawyer and author of Cross-Examining History, a lawyer gets answers from the experts about our presidents. Thanks for the hour.
You bet. Thank you, Mike.